And we're going to try to shed a little bit more light on the answer to, is breakfast the most important meal of the day?
Gosh, so, just for a second, what part of your life has that been drilled into your...
Essentially all 30, I'm 35 now, so yeah. I think 35 years. I mean, probably in the last few years when I started getting more information about intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
And, eating based on your circadian rhythm or time-restricted eating. That was only till recently, but like you said, growing up, it was both most important meal of the day, helps kids, think clearly, helps mental capacity, yada, yada, yada. And even now they're talking about how it boosts your metabolism. That was the one term, the thing that
everybody would say. You want to eat breakfast. The whole thing was you want to eat breakfast because your body needs to start early. It needs to start.
You're listening to the Addicted to Fitness podcast, brought to you by Elemental Training Tampa. Now, here's your hosts, Nick and Shannon Birch.
Thanks for stopping by and checking out this week's episode of the Addicted to Fitness podcast. We are back at you this week with some new research and some kind of like favorite topics, I feel like, mm-hmm. because they're kind of related to some of our favorite foods.
Yes.
And I think we've got a good episode for you.
Yeah, trying to answer
we
that.
Finally, we've come to the day. Shannon is my.
My phone is legit haunted. How did that even happen?
Whoa.
My phone started playing one of our podcasts. I mean, no offense to us, I wasn't listening to our podcast recently. I listened to like 3 others since I listened to our last podcast.
Wow, that was crazy. Anywho, but I was like I was saying about the topic we're talking about today, we were going to probably try to answer that age-old question, is breakfast the most important meal of the day? But before we get there, training recaps.
Yes, I will kick it off. Last episode, we spoke about how kind of we were both like reinvigorated mm-hmm. and we had like all of this wonderful energy towards training, and I was starting a new Peloton program for power zones. And last, I think I spoke, I was about to do, or I had just done the power zone test, and I think I was about to do it. And I did it. I did follow through, and I did the FTP test. Mm-hmm. It was a fitness test. And it was like basically like you push as hard as you can for 20 minutes, and then you take your average heart rate from that time period, or not your average heart rate, your average output. And then you plug that into the bike, and what the bike actually does is it changes your display screen if you enable this feature. And so you actually are given your power zone in addition to your output.
Mm-hmm.
It shows you like a visual representation of where you are in your power zone. So you don't have to kind of guess
right.
to mate where you are. So I had the best of intentions to do all of the, I was hoping to do at least 3 of the 4 classes that they have slated for week 2 mm-hmm. this week. But then I'm kind of thinking just typically does recently, like in the last couple of years, something comes up and changes plans. Mm-hmm. And it was the fact that we had about 4 nights of just really, really crap sleep. Like
yeah.
just, I mean, it took us ages to get to sleep most nights. A couple of nights we were waking up throughout the night. Most of the nights I think I was like just awake on and off all mm-hmm. night. And it was because Ella was sick.
Yeah.
And then you ended up getting sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had something fighting at me. So, yeah. And my goal of 3 turned out to be 1.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did this morning, but I was super proud of myself this morning because I was like, at least I got 1.
Yeah.
At least I got 1 in there. I got to experience what it was like to do the power zone with the little screen, and I even put a picture of it. I did it at like 6 o'clock this morning. I was really proud of myself. So I only did one, but you know, that's a win. And then I also, you know, I did get to do a little bit of yoga this week at home, but like minimal, very brief, kind of just to move my body a little bit. I also like hurt my back last weekend at some point. I mean, like these are just the things that seem to happen regularly. But something that I did get to do, I got to teach a meditation class at my office.
Nice.
And I have done that once before, and I had one participant. It was last December. And that person, like, I was actually really encouraged because that one person was like, this was amazing. Oh, my gosh. Like, this helped me so much. So I was like, I want to do this again. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do it again. I'm very passionate about mindfulness and meditation. So I figured I'd give it a go. I'm very happy to report I doubled my attendance. And I had two people in my class this week. And one of them was a very advanced practitioner of meditation. He's gone to like week-long retreats where he meditated for 11 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how to, like, my brain can't even comprehend that. But even like he had some really nice feedback for me. He said, you know, it was really nice and relaxing. And he invited me. Apparently, he meditates every morning in his office.
Nice.
So he invited me and the other person, who is one of our creative department. He's like, you guys want to come meditate anytime? Mm. I was like, thanks, man. So, you know, meditation, bringing people together. I hope to do many more of those in the future. I think even if I only reach a handful of people in my office building, I feel like it's a good thing. It's like a positive energy for a building of stress.
Yeah. I need to get back to regular meditation. I was using, you know, try to do the daily Headspace app, even if it was 5 minutes. And especially this week, I fell off the wagon, like you mentioned, just battling a cold or whatever I was battling, allergies, whatever it may be. It just kind of kicked my butt in the gym too. It kind of really just ran me down. My energy level was super low. I think I got one workout in, and it was, you know, kind of a half-assed workout. But one thing I was pretty proud of was teaching some mace flows to a couple clients.
Nice.
So I got to instruct a couple, two specifically, about a couple different portions of the master mace flow I learned at my mace training class. So that was cool to show those guys that. So other than that, training is popping right now.
Yeah.
I mean, my training schedule is really full up right now, and it's awesome. So really, really kind of helping the most people, like directly, that I have since I started, you know, the personal training business. So
that's awesome.
At this point in time. So it's quite a milestone, and hopefully, like I said, I'll just bounce back, start feeling 100% so I can get my strength training in, because that's super important, and start getting my meditations in, because as you said, it is needed.
Yeah, and I mean, I think I will say that something that I feel we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to, like, bounce back from major and minor things. But the truth is, like, you're always in some kind of flux.
Yeah.
And it's not so much like
she
this
said flux.
Idea.
Flux.
Flux. I would say flux.
Flux.
That was not a swear word, if anyone was wondering. Flux.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that we don't give ourselves enough credit that we're kind of always there. We're never like, we don't reach a flatline point of 100% and then just stay there and then all of a sudden get crappy and then we bounce back to 100%. We're kind of always in this ebb and flow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of starting to learn to work with your sort of ebbs and flows and shift what you're doing to kind of complement it more.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of thinking like all or none, it has to be all workouts and heavy training, cutting yourself some slack and, you know, really diving more in on like the meditation, And some of those lower key kind of mm-hmm. moments when you're not feeling great actually are just as good as if you just focus on heavy training all the time. And I mean, I know you know this. I'm not really saying this to school you by any right. means, but it is something, given our constant fluctuation of being healthy and then not being healthy over the last, I'd say, like 3 or 4 months, mm-hmm. it's sort of drilled that home. Like, we're never just 100% and then go, go, go. Like, that's where we live on average.
Right.
We are constantly working to get yep. to healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when you are healthy, quote unquote, you have to just freaking enjoy yeah, it, love it.
You get training recaps like we did last week, essentially.
Where yeah, we were exactly. We were on it up.
Yeah.
We were on an up week.
Yeah, we were on the up. Now one of us is still kind of going up, one of us down.
One but, of us is just hanging on, like hoping that I don't get knocked down. It's like, I'm going to keep going, guys. I'm going to try to pull up the slack.
Yeah. So that's good. I'm glad you're still kicking butt, and that Peloton thing still sounds pretty trucking. Cool. So
yeah, I would
keep
say
us updated on that.
when you're back to a higher point and you feel so compelled, maybe give the FTP test a try.
Yeah, I definitely will. That was one of my goals, like weekly goals, was to do the Peloton at least once. So I really need to get back on that. So as we mentioned in the beginning, we are our main topic of discussion and around, I think, honestly, it's my the favorite meal of the day, even though I don't eat it every day.
I know.
It is breakfast. And we're going to try to shed a little bit more light on the answer to, is breakfast the most important meal of the day?
Gosh, so what part of your life has that been drilled into your...
Essentially all 30... I'm 35 now, so I think 35 years. I mean, probably in the last few years when I started getting more information about intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
And, you know, eating based on your circadian rhythm or time-restricted eating, that started getting a little bit more about... that breakfast isn't necessarily the most important meal of the day. So
yeah,
that was only till recently. But like you said, growing up, it was both most important meal of the day, helps kids, you know, think clearly, helps mental capacity, yada, yada, yada. And even now they're talking about how it boosts your metabolism. That was the one term, the thing that everybody would say.
You want to eat breakfast. The whole thing was you want to eat breakfast because your body needs to start early, it needs to start metabolizing, and if you don't eat breakfast, it doesn't start till later, so it has less time to metabolize your food.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was what basically we heard for years,
right?
For decades, really. Mm-hmm.
And earlier this year, the BMJ, which is, let's see what this is. now I need to find out what BMJ
means. I was just
means.
Looking at BM, the BM.
How dare you? The British Medical Journal. I think that's what BMJ stands
that's
for.
So much
British
better Medical than where Journal. I was going with it.
Dirty, dirty girl.
It's just a bodily function. Come on.
I'm pretty sure that's what BMJ stands for, so I'm going to ride with that. Medical Journal. Pretty sure that's what it means. So they published a study.
They don't use Z's. They use S's.
Oh, okay. So the effect of breakfast on weight and energy intake, a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized controlled studies. So this wasn't necessarily a study itself. They actually analyzed studies over the past 30 years, and they focused on randomized controlled trials. So to let you know what that means, I wanted to make sure I get the definition of it. It is a type of scientific experiment which aims to reduce bias when testing for a new treatment or for a specific hypothesis. So the hypothesis in that one is breakfast. They probably thought, I don't know if hypothesis, but breakfast is the most important meal of the day. So they tried to do random controlled studies to prove that. And the people participating in these types of trials are randomly allocated to either the group receiving the treatment or under investigation, or the group receiving standard treatment. So there's a control group, and then there's an experimental group. So these types of studies are much more, I would say, prove a lot more causation than correlation. You know, a lot of times you guys see studies in the news saying, hey, red meat can cause cancer.
Yeah, and it's a correlation.
So a lot of those are based on epidemiological studies that say which prove correlation, not causation. Randomized controlled studies have a little bit more information on the cause of certain hypothesis, what they're trying to investigate.
It was like earlier this year when we actually brought you a study that talked about how social media actually caused people to be like more depressed and have issues. Whereas previously, they really didn't have any facts that proved a direct impact. They were just correlating the data. They didn't actually have the 100% truth on that.
Right. So in this BMJ study, this meta-analysis done by the BAJ, their objective was to examine the effect of regular breakfast consumption on weight change and energy intake in people living in high-income countries. So over 30 years, they found 13 trials that studied this objective. And what they discovered was that the addition of breakfast might not be a good strategy for weight loss, regardless of the established breakfast habit. So,
interesting.
They said the caution is needed when recommending breakfast for weight loss in adults, as it could have the opposite effect. Further randomized controlled trials of high quality are needed to examine the role of breakfast eating in the approach to weight management. So from what the studies they've seen over the last 30 years, there, especially when you're talking about weight gain or weight control, there is no solid evidence in the studies they found that suggests that you have to eat breakfast in order to kind of lose weight or kind of boost your metabolism to burn fat and or lose weight.
And it might actually have the reverse effect.
Possibly,
some people. Which, especially because I like, you know, like the term high-income countries, like, let's be honest, they're not studying people in a third world country that are, like, just trying to get food in their bodies. This is where, like, food is not probably an issue for the audience that they're studying. They're looking at people who choose, where it's an optional thing, like how you're going to eat your breakfast.
Right. And it's there's actually a really cool kind of link inside that article from the BMJ. There's an opinion piece from one of the professors, I guess, that probably contributes to the BMJ. His name is Tim Spector. He's a professor of genetic epidemiology. One more time. Epidemiology. Dang it.
You just said demonology, didn't you?
Tim Spector, professor of genetic epidemiology. Why can't I say it? Say it for me one more time. You fill in the blank for me. Okay. Tim Spector, professor of genetic
epidemiology. Oh, no, I did it too.
This guy's a very...
Epidemiology.
Yes, thank you. At King's College in London. So
clearly, this is not where we're going to school.
He wrote his opinion piece based on not only the findings of this meta-analysis that we were talking about, but he actually gave a little bit of insight that there's actually data coming out now that suggests that skipping breakfast can be actually a useful strategy to reduce weight. And as Shannon mentioned, it's different for different people, obviously different groups, obviously low income and high income it's different for, but also there, it's people that are obese people and people that have diabetes. They find that a lot of the time those individuals are skipping meals more often than thin people. Or people that are, I guess, of the a BMI of normal BMI, and then they find that they're skipping breakfast, so that leads people to think, well, you can't skip breakfast. Look, these people are obese or have type 2 diabetes, but there's really they have no real correlation between that because it's not a good they don't have any good evidence to suggest that. It's just people are kind of correlated, and once again, to see that they have these.
They're only taking a segment of a population, and then they're studying that and saying, well, they're this way because of this.
Mm. And then and it's talk, and Tim Spector talks about it in his opinion piece about how it's almost kind of like nutritional dogma. That's a phrase he uses, that you have to have breakfast.
It's true.
It's almost like it's almost become essentially policy in a lot of USDA, different countries like England. He's talking about Australia, guidelines for nutrition, that this is what you're giving these guidelines to have a certain type of meal with a certain amount of calories or from certain food groups for your breakfast when you get up in the morning.
Yeah. And obviously, I, over the last couple, 2-3 years now, have been studying Ayurveda. And they had a very, like, interesting explanation of why having a large breakfast, which, and having, like, heavy breakfast and having animal products at breakfast is kind of like the stupidest thing. And it makes a lot of sense when you think about it, because they look at your metabolism, they call it your digestive fire. Mm-hmm. And they say that, you know, think about, like, literally think about your digestion like fire. At night, the fire dies down. You know, it's just in kind of like smoldering mode. You're not burning heavy calories. You're just, it's just kind of in like almost a sleep state. Then you get up, and then if you're told to eat like a bunch of heavy breakfast, think about what putting a bunch of heavy things on a fire when it's been smoldering, like barely going all night. Mm-hmm. What do? Like, if you were actually doing that to a fire, like,
well, yeah, you smother it.
Mm-hmm. And so it's going to have way more difficult time to, like, get itself going when you give it that kind of breakfast.
Right.
They suggested, you know, it's a very, like, small, very specific, very light kind of breakfast that's sort of meant to start building your fire back up. And when you think about it, that makes perfect sense, because of course your digestion's not going to be able to go from 0 to 100.
Right.
And, I mean, for all of the people that start their day with something like a smoothie, or not necessarily a cold smoothie, but or like a small bowl of porridge or something, that might work for them, because that's not a huge, giant breakfast.
Right. Yeah, I think portion size is a huge thing.
The type of thing.
And content, because Spector mentioned this in his article towards the end. It's like, and we've said it so many times on this podcast, it's not a one-size-fits-all.
You know,
your metabolism is your metabolism, and you react differently. You may benefit from eating breakfast in the morning, like a small something small, you know, high in fiber, maybe to get your digestion going, but also has a little bit of the right kind of ratio of protein and fat, and or if you need some carbs, if you work better on carbs in the morning, that might be what you need. But, you know, just especially giving kids a bowl of cereal in the middle of the morning,
a
bowl of sugar that has zero nutritional value. I mean, that's
or
really doing
bacon,
them a disservice.
And eggs and sausage,
right,
and like these big massive like, you know, not to call them out, but like Denny's style breakfast or like diner style breakfast. That is just not start your day off.
We love Brinner or brunch.
Oh my gosh, yes.
I almost said that. I was like, what's still a word for breakfast at lunch? And I was like, wait a second.
Wow.
Brunch.
It exists.
Yeah. We love brunch. I mean, I love breakfast food.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that kind of gives us a nice segue into our next topic, but I think it's safe to say the debate kind of is rolling on a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think what we want to get across is that it's not necessarily bad to skip breakfast.
Yeah.
If it works for you, like me, I'm usually typically when I wake up, I'll wake up anytime between 4 and 4:30, or 4 and 5. I'll give that window. I won't eat till 9 or 10 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I won't eat solid food. You know, I'll drink coffee, have a little bit of collagen in there, maybe some non-dairy creamer, but that's like what gets me to about 9 or 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
Then I'll eat some eggs and stuff like that. Oh, I let it out of the bag. That's our next topic. We're talking about my favorite breakfast food. Probably one of my favorite.
I think you planned that.
Yeah, probably one of my favorite foods. Honestly, one of
in
my
general.
Favorite foods. Yeah. Period. Put an exclamation point
any
on it.
Any time of day.
And that is eggs. So I want to talk about this because not only is it related to breakfast, because I would say, you know, when you think of breakfast foods, you think eggs, essentially.
In America, yeah.
Yeah. And I heard a recent kind of people talking on the podcast about bad-mouthing my beloved eggs. So I wanted to look up and give you guys some information on why I think eggs are the healthiest food on the planet. So I found a great article on Healthline.com. This is a site that we look at often and refer, you know, reference in the podcast a lot. The guy, I think, who started this is called Chris Gunners. I started following him way back. It was actually called, Authority Nutrition. He started a website called Authority Nutrition, and it actually got bought by Healthline. And now he's basically kind of one of the main contributors, along with other dietitians, nutritionalists, PhDs. They contribute a lot of articles on this website. So I really like this website. So his article is 6 Reasons Why Eggs Are the Healthiest Foods on the Planet. Okay? So we're going to run through this list, but then we're also going to go into a little bit of detail about each one, okay? So first one is eggs for breakfast can help you lose body fat. So the reason why they or why Chris associated eating eggs for lose body fat is because they are very satiating. You know, they have a ton of protein and fat, which usually helps people stay fuller longer, which would contribute them to people eating less calories or less kind of empty calories throughout the day. What about the next one?
So the next one would be eggs are loaded with lutein and...
Get it?
Zeaxanthin?
Yeah.
Why? This is why you gave this one to me, isn't it?
I believe these are vitamin A derivatives.
And they're specifically meant to protect your eyes.
Yeah. So, I mean, that one's kind of self-explanatory, you know. But one thing I do want to mention is that they are contained in the yolk. So I know a lot of people are going are big egg whites people just because they don't want the fats associated with the yolks.
The calories,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. But these important antioxidants are contained in the yolk. So don't neglect your yolks, people. All right.
No yolk.
We're not yolking around. Yes, we did it.
Egg puns.
All right, so the next one is eggs contain high-quality proteins with a perfect amino acid profile. So this is something that's really important, I think, when you kind of get into the conversation about eating vegetarian and or vegan opposed to maybe being like a vegan to a certain extent, because there are certain proteins that not all plant-based proteins have, but, you know, eggs are one of those ones that have all 21 amino acids that body uses to build proteins. So I don't want to knock vegetarianism or veganism, but I feel like they kind of, I think they're missing out on eggs because that's and another thing, and we can get into this a little bit more. Chickens produce eggs, right?
Right.
But a vegan doesn't eat any animal byproducts.
They don't eat any products or byproducts. They don't eat anything that comes from or is related to an animal.
Okay. But the chicken's going to lay an egg whether you like it or not, right?
Right, but it's your choice to eat it, just like chickens exist, so it's your choice whether to eat them.
But the chicken egg is not a viable animal.
Well, it's the same thing as honey. Vegans, like true vegans, they don't eat honey either.
Right. Oh, I get it.
So it's any animal, anything that comes from an animal. And like they don't wear leather. They don't, you know, they don't drink milk because milk is from a cow.
I get it.
And it's the idea that it's that egg is supposed to be a chicken.
Okay.
Like, I know that the eggs we eat are the unfertilized ones, but it's not like they're all the unfertilized eggs that you went and collected in your hen house. They're mass produced that way. They're like made to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
So no vegan would consider eating an egg because it's basically just manufactured.
Right. But I mean, they eat manufactured food as in like soy,
right?
Like
but it's
tofu.
It's like, but to your point, the fact that it's not going to be like a chicken, and it's just from a chicken,
right? It's not going to be a chicken.
Right. But okay. It's from a chicken.
Okay.
We're going to go down a totally different road.
Let's
here.
Get back to eggs. All right. So the next one we want to talk about is
eggs. Oh, God.
Yeah. Come on.
Eggs are loaded with choline, yep. an important nutrient for the brain because it's often grouped with B complex vitamins. Yes,
and that's another one that's found in a lot of animal protein is B complex vitamins. And choline is a really super important one. And obviously, as Shannon said, it's high in egg yolks. But it's important for a lot of various processes, including the synthesize? It is required to synthesize the neurotransmitter acetylcholine and is also a component of cell membranes. Boom. Look at all those multiple syllabic words that I got in there. Oh, God. It's also very important to pregnant women. Studies show that low choline intake can raise the risk of neurotube defects and lead to decreased cognitive function in babies.
Oh, jeez.
So I actually do remember talking about that when we were pregos, when you were pregos with Ella.
Yeah.
So, because I think it's actually an important component of your prenatal vitamin, choline is. It's up there with folate, too. All right. So the next one is, and this is kind of just a catch-all of everything. Eggs are one of the most nutritious foods on the planet. They have a ton of B12, B2, vitamin A, B5, selenium. They also have small amounts of every vitamin and mineral required by the human body. How about that?
Well, yeah, because eggs are part of what make another creature.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, they're going to be loaded with vitamins.
Yep, and if you guys are interested, one large egg contains 77 calories, 6 grams of quality protein, 5 grams of fat, and trace amounts of carbohydrates. Boom. All right, so the last but not least one, because this is one thing that we wanted to kind of expound on a little bit, because you found an article related to this week also. Mm-hmm. Eggs improve your cholesterol. One more time. Eggs improve your cholesterol profile and do not raise your risk of heart disease. Bum-ba-da-bum.
So that was, I remember, that was like one of the biggest reasons that we were told not to eat that many, like to really severely moderate your egg intake, and like this is what gave egg yolks a bad rap.
Mm-hmm.
Was
exactly right.
their impact supposedly making you have higher risk of heart disease and high cholesterol.
Yes, and Chris Gunner is in this basically in this little tab about the cholesterol profile, the effect of eggs on the cholesterol profile. He referenced a couple different studies that actually say that eggs can actually improve your cholesterol profile. They raise HDL, the good cholesterol, and they tend to change the LDL, the bad cholesterol, to a large subtype, which is not as strongly associated with an increased risk of heart disease. And we've touched about this a little bit about low-density LDL, high-density LDL, the difference, and how that might be the main contributor to a heart disease. But he's talking about how eating eggs, cholesterol associated with eggs, actually has the exact effect of raising good cholesterol and lowering a certain type of the bad cholesterol. So you found a nice article, or an interesting article, I should say, talking about basically they looked at a study that said something about the effect of eggs on people's cholesterol.
Yeah, so the kind of the thing that caught my eye about this was it was like, you've been told that eggs are healthy, but are they? You know? And I was like, come on. Like, you cannot do this again. And it addressed that whole topic of do the eggs really cause, like, high cholesterol? Because right. There was this study that was made that said that there was an increased risk of developing heart disease if you consumed 2 eggs per day and blah, blah, blah. But they basically examined this. This was a NPR story, actually, that we pulled this from. But they published this article where researchers behind the JAMA, mm-hmm. J-A-M-A yep. study, that did actually track about 30,000 adults' health in long-term studies. They took a pretty close look at the kind of the data, mm-hmm. and there were really kind of some conflicting conclusions in the different data points and different conclusions people were pulling. And there really was no direct evidence that by limiting your consumption of cholesterol-rich foods, you're also going to lower your chances of, or your artery-clogging LDL cholesterol. So basically, they came back and said, the new studies and things might want to lead you to think that, oh no, eggs are really mm-hmm. bad for you again, and foods like eggs should be dropped from your diet. But there really is still nothing compelling to say that that's the case. And I think that there's already been like a significant amount of people saying it's still not like safe to eat like a load of eggs.
Right.
But moderate consumption, you know, is fine.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's we talked about, and the reason why I kind of gave you guys the definition of randomized controlled studies or trials earlier is because comparison to that, these people, this study was basically used surveys. They sent out surveys to those 30,000. Yeah. So those 30,000 people they studied over 17 years, they asked them one time about their diets to see what kind of food they ate and then associated with their health, whether they had heart disease or whatnot. So that's kind of a downfall or somewhat of a shortcoming of tests like this. Okay. Is that you, especially surveys, when you ask, and a lot of people, they even talk about how when you ask somebody to keep a food journal, they lie so much.
Yeah.
The amount of data.
People don't even pay attention if they're not keeping a food journal, then they definitely don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, and then when you ask them, hey, what did you eat for breakfast 2 weeks ago? You're like,
I had some eggs.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, and those are kind of
half
the shortcomings.
A cow.
Yeah, exactly. These are the shortcomings of these types of articles, but, you know, we see a lot of headlines based off studies like this.
Yeah.
That are because they're jaw-dropping. Just because they are so broad, they come to conclusions, big, broad conclusions that are kind of emotional, like invoking emotions or kind of reactions, I should say. So that's why you got to take a dig a little deeper and find more studies that do things like double-blind placebo studies, randomized controlled trials. Those actually test the actual whatever it
causation.
Be. Exactly. They try to prove causation opposed to correlation. That's really where it comes down to.
I mean, if I'm being honest, as someone who has worked, actually, like, done studies, made news announcements out of them, and then pitched them to media for clients for over a decade, it's kind of terrifying how easy it is to just throw out the fact that you did a survey or, quote, a study, and pull data from that and then spin it like it's fact.
Yeah.
Because a lot of it is based off of speculation almost in a way, because you're only taking into consideration the data that you want to tell a story with.
Right.
I'm not even kidding. Like, we've ignored other results in surveys because they didn't tell the story we wanted to.
Right.
And when you're a PR person pitching media, this is what you do, and this is how you get the headlines, and this is how media gets excited, because they're like, we're going to totally scare the crap out of people.
So it's
super important.
You got to see who funded the study, where the study was done, you know, all that kind of stuff contributes, because bias is real. And trust me, I have confirmation bias. I love eggs. That's why I'm promoting them so much, okay? But, you know, it exists in everything, but you got to take a little deeper look at the test or the study to find out how legitimate it is,
mm-hmm.
To see if you should really base any type of nutritional decisions on those headlines, essentially.
Yes. So we keep trying to break down the news for you of mm-hmm. different health topics, and Nick is really good about passing his scientific kind of background, applying it and really looking at whether or not these are legitimate or not.
Right.
I am usually the one that is like, hey, this is interesting, but it sounds... It sounds misleading.
Right.
Like that's about as deep as I can get.
Yeah. No, but so. it's good. So because we want to educate people. That's the main goal of this podcast: educate you, entertain you.
Yeah.
And also to introduce you guys to new not only aspects of fitness but fitness and health pros.
Yeah.
Just a little segue because next week we got an awesome interview with another health and fitness pro. So you guys stay tuned for that. And you guys can go back in our archive and listen to all our other interviews or our cool little health challenges or whatever we did, taste tests, all the different types of episodes we've done here on the podcast.
Yeah. And remember, if you ever come across an article or a study or a research or something, and you are concerned about what it is saying and you maybe want a second look, send it on our way. We've got all of our information on our Facebook page, on our website, addictedtofitnesspodcast.com, and we would be happy to look into it for you.
Yes, and we're going to go into something we started last week, was podcast recommendations. We're going to give that to you guys right now. Shannon did last week. I was listening to a very interesting podcast, one of my favorite podcasters. I've mentioned him on the podcast many times before, Joe Rogan. His podcast, The Joe Rogan Experience, he interviewed someone on March 11th. His name is, I'm going to probably butcher the last name, Peter Hotitz?
Yeah, I have no Peter idea. Hotez?
H-O-T-E-Z. Okay, and that is episode 1261. Sorry, 1261. Jeez, my bad.
Still like ridiculous.
So yes, but that was from March 11th. Peter is an MD and PhD, the Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and Professor of Pediatrics and Molecular Virology and Microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine.
Basically, he has a crap ton of titles that are super impressive on their own.
A lot of the podcasts talked about, especially at the beginning, talked about the vaccine and the anti-vaccine movement and how that is affecting basically communicable diseases in this country right now. And obviously, Peter, he was laid down the law about how especially kind of at the center of that anti-vax debate, not even only just, you know, having your own choice, but people that put autism on vaccines causing autism. And he basically broke it down about how we've actually proven now that that is not the case. The vaccines do not cause autism. They've actually identified genes that cause autism. So they can actually... He was talking about, and I'm sorry, if I definitely got to go back and listen to it, but they can actually analyze a child's genes, I think, before 18 months to determine whether or not they will have autism. And it's actually before – it must be less than that because it's before they get the measles and rubella vaccination.
Okay.
Because they can actually – it must be 6 months. They said they've analyzed the genes of 6 months old or previous to those vaccines and determined whether or not the person was going to have autism or not. So they've actually got it to a genetic markers. So really interesting podcast. I highly recommend, guys, because that's a topic we talk about here on the podcast, vaccines and anti-vaccines, vacciners. I think we're solidly in the vaccine camp.
We like to continuously look at the debate though, because you know it is very important to us, but it's also there's a lot of passion around it, and you can't ignore that when you've got people staking. There's some pretty high stakes involved, it's important to take into consideration all sides of the story. So we kind of continue to keep looking for updates
That was a great piece of information to help with that type of topic and that debate. So
yeah.
Check it out. Joe Rogan Experience. Peter Hotitz.
Hotez.
From March 11th. So Hotez. H-O-T-E-Z. So that's my recommendation for the week.
All right.
All right. Do you got anything else for him this week?
Nope, I'm done.
All right. This has been another edition of the Addicted to Fitness podcast, and we'll check you next time.
See ya.
For all things Addicted to Fitness, you can check out our website, addictedtofitnesspodcast.com. You can also give us a follow on Twitter, @TheATFPodcast, and like and follow the Addicted to Fitness podcast Facebook page. Last but not least, please give us a rating and review in the iTunes store. Thanks.